You're listening to So Far and Yet So Near on 209 Cambridge Community Radio. Many thanks for joining us. I'm Derek Thorne.
And I'm Hannah Higginson. In this episode, moving on from fair trade, the next step for campaigners trying to force businesses to be more ethical.
How desert ferns have inspired Cambridge scientists to help prevent disease in the world's hottest countries.
And we get a musical history lesson from two Cambridge-based South Africans and a German.
And to start, the South African film Tsotsi, which is set to come out in the UK in March. Now, this is an unusual and really very good movie that looks at a few remarkable days in the life of a young gangster living in a poor area or township of Johannesburg. Now, Hannah and I were lucky enough to go and see this film a full 2 months before its release at a special preview screening at which the director, Gavin Hood, was present and answering questions. So, after all his commitments, he was kind enough to answer my questions, and he began by telling me about his new film.
Tsotsi is sort of 6 days in the life of a very troubled young shantytown gangster who's been living a life of pretty extreme urban deprivation and without sort of parents and has pretty much raised himself and become the leader of a fairly tough gang. And one night he drives off in a carjacking. He steals a woman's car and discovers that he has a three-month-old baby in the back seat. And as he looks over his shoulder and hears this little cry, he leaves the road and crashes the car. He then hears his baby screaming, continuously screaming, as he sort of cleans out the car and robs it of whatever he can take. And finally, on impulse, decides to take this baby with him into the shanty towns. And he hides it from his fellow gang members. And there are some sort of fairly distressing and yet comic at the same time moments where he attempts to sort of feed this baby and is completely useless. He then compels a young woman who's breastfeeding a child of her own to breastfeed this child at gunpoint. And so begins a very strange and strained and frightening relationship that gradually shifts in terms of its power, from him having the power at the end of a gun to her having a kind of power based on her ability to nurture this child. And slowly she begins to bring out of him where he's from, her primary interest not being him at first, but the child. So it's by no means a sort of contrived love affair, but it's a way for her to try and find out whose child this is and ultimately to try to get it back to its real mother.
Firstly, I was really interested in the way you shot the townships.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, the way you were really, it seemed to be portraying South Africa in a rather different way to before, and the absence of the issue of race, really. I mean, tell me about that. Class was more important here.
Yes, I think that, you know, of course race is still an issue in South Africa, but thankfully far less so, and the issues of class are becoming far more important, and the discrepancy between the wealthy and the poor as we get a rising black middle class and upper class and upper class, and we still have a great many wealthy white people, but we also have increasing numbers of very poor white people. But I wanted the film to be based very much on what Fugard's central idea always is in his work, which is that you focus primarily on the character that you're exploring. And the social and economic and political environment in which they find themselves is brought to the fore not because you shove anyone's nose into the politics, but because it's part of the environment in which that particular character and their troubles and their secrets and their dilemmas and their anger and repressed nature is living. And as they explore who they are, so their environment is brought to your attention. And that's a very clever way of giving an audience a sense of the politics without saying, this is a movie all about politics. It's really a movie about a person in a particular set of circumstances. And that's Fugard's brilliance.
And the final very quick question about the actors. Were they professional?
Well, we have a combination of actors who've doing a film for the very first time, in particular the lead, who's extraordinary. This is his first film. The female lead is her first film. And then we have some actors who have master's degrees in theatre. One in particular, who's a man in a wheelchair, has actually a master's degree from university in theatre studies. And the other, a young man, has an honours degree in theatre, who plays one of the township gang members. So we had a mixture of actors who were highly classically trained and actors who had not acted on film before. And when I say not on film before, one of the things that was true is even the actors who had not acted on film, we found in community theatre halls in shanty towns and townships doing community theatre. So they had a passion for acting and were very, very, very determined to do it right. And so bringing them into the rehearsal room weeks before we started shooting and simply helping them understand the medium of film and working very hard was fun. It was great because what I had with these actors was actors who truly had great emotional range, and it was just a matter of adapting them to a new medium. But they did a fantastic job.
That was Gavin Hood speaking there, and you'll probably notice that he mentioned Fugard. Now, the film Sotsi was actually based on a novel by Atoll Fugard, who's a South African playwright mainly, but also novelist, so also do check out the book Sotsi by him if you wish. Now, the advanced screening was put on in collaboration with the Cambridge African Film Festival, and one of the festival co-directors, Joelle Cabrita, was present too. And I managed to speak to her briefly about the festival and its role in the community.
The Cambridge African Film Festival was started about 5 years ago, and it's now grown to be one of, well, the only film festival in the UK that's exclusively dedicated to African cinema. So it's really a one-off. And we had our last festival in May of this year, and we had 20 African films, and we hosted about 10 directors who came up from Africa, who gave Q&As after the films on their work, and who introduced them and did educational workshops. And this year's festival is happening in November. And we're hoping to host Gavin Hood and do a retrospective of this film and his previous two films.
Excellent. And so it must be a real variety then. I mean, African Film Festival could encompass a huge amount. Can you give us an idea of that variety?
Well, in this previous year's festival, we had films from Morocco, Egypt, Lesotho, South Africa, Burkina Faso, Kenya. We had a film from Mali. We had a film from Senegal. So it's totally the whole range of the continent. And it's everything from Arabic film to Zulu film to Swahili film to Sufa film. Like, it's totally diverse.
What kind of role would you like the festival to be playing in the community in Cambridge as well, which is, you know, a very diverse city?
Well, the festival for this year, 2006, is going to be linked with Black History Month, which is an annual month of celebrating Black history in communities in Britain. And obviously, Britain is an incredibly diverse society culturally, and Black immigrants are a massive part of what Britain is today, and Black Britain is incredibly significant. So for us, we see the film as not being only about Africa, but about the African experience that's lived in Britain today, and the diasporic African experience. So we hope to be relevant to Black communities living in Britain, and we also hope to, you know, kind of forge some kind of multicultural understanding between communities in Africa and Black communities here in Britain.
That was Joelle Cabrita talking about the Cambridge African Film Festival. Look out for that in November. And also keep your eyes peeled for the release of Sotsi, and why not listen to 209's cinema programme, Bums on Seat, which will be covering it fully around the March time.
You're listening to So Far and Yet So Near on 209 Cambridge Community Radio. And don't forget, you can podcast our show if you are so inclined. Hit the podcast link on our page and also check out the Frequently Asked Questions section, which covers everything about podcasting.
Now, you may remember that last week we visited some of the shops in Cambridge where you can buy ethical products. Well, we went along to CB2 on Mill Road on Tuesday the 17th of January to attend a talk given by a man who knows a thing or two and more about ethical or not-so-ethical business. Craig Bennett is head of the Corporate Accountability Campaign for Friends of the Earth, and we asked him to tell us about his work.
For over 30 years, Friends of the Earth has been campaigning against the specific impacts that companies are having, damaging the environment and having no regard to the way they behave in communities. But over the last few years, we've decided we want to run a campaign that will really change fundamentally the way corporations operate. That's why we set up our corporate accountability campaign, which is campaigning for changes to the legal frameworks in which companies operate, so that there's clear laws that says that they have to operate not just for profit, but also for people and the planet.
So what is this campaign a reaction to?
Our corporate accountability campaign is really looking at the growing power that corporations have gained over the last few decades. What we see now is that of the top 100 economies in the world, 51 are companies and only 49 are countries. That's a huge amount of power rested in a very small number of hands, and hands which aren't democratically elected. And so what we really want to do is to turn that round, give power back to people, and that's the main purpose of our campaign.
And do you feel that this is an extension sort of beyond the fair trade or ethical movements?
I think what we've seen over the last few decades is ethical consumerism, fair trade, has been incredibly powerful at demonstrating, firstly, that there are a lot of consumers out there that care about these issues, and secondly, that it is possible to make and sell products in an ethical way. What they haven't been able to do, however, and what I would do is argue that it's never going to be able to do, is make all products ethical all the time. So I think it's really important for those of us who are activists and concerned about these issues to now shift and not give up being ethical consumers or promoting ethical consumerism, not that at all, but shift into really saying now is the time for governments to understand that the public cares deeply about these issues, and now it's over to politicians to really put the laws in place that make sure all companies are ethical all the time.
And how do you go about forcing governments to make those changes?
The first thing is that we have to recognise it can't be done by just one organisation alone, like Friends of the Earth. We have to work in coalitions. So for example, in the UK, we do have the Corporate Responsibility Coalition, which is a really strong coalition of groups like Friends of the Earth, Amnesty International. In fact, over 130 organisations, including trade unions, all campaigning for a change to UK company law. We have similar networks at a European level. And ultimately, there's also a huge international corporate accountability movement and coalition now.
And do you think you've got enough power to sort of, I guess on the other side of that, there's the companies campaigning to maintain their power. Do you feel positive about the future?
We should be under no illusions that this is a hugely ambitious campaign. And, you know, you can't really think of a bigger opponent than the corporate sector that is putting all their might and all their muscle and all their money into lobbying against us. But what we do have on our side are people and arguments. And when you have people and arguments working together, that can really persuade politicians to do the right thing. But we have to know this isn't one of those campaigns that's going to be won in a year or 2 years. It's going to take 20, 30 years.
So if people wanted to get involved in this campaign, what could they do?
I think what we really need people to do now is become activists and not just think of themselves as ethical consumers. Carry on buying the fair trade coffee, carry on buying the peat-free compost, carry on buying the wood that's certified by the Forest Stewardship Council, but don't see that as all you have to do. The important thing is to get involved with organisations like Friends of the Earth, not just Friends of the Earth, but organisations like ours, and get active. Get on activist lists, join email action lists, or join as members, or subscribe to some of the free activist lists that most organisations have now, and take those simple steps that we give you about how to democratically persuade your Member of Parliament or other decision makers of the need for corporate accountability. And over time, when we see thousands of people engaging in that, we'll see a real difference.
That was Craig Bennett. And if you want to find out more about the campaign, go to allthews@foe.co.uk.
Now, some events for your diary happening over the next 3 weeks.
Well, there's a series of talks coming up that are held at Chesterton Community College about going abroad. You can go to a talk on for doing voluntary services overseas in Vietnam. Other topics to be covered include travel in Lebanon, Namibia, and also searching for snow leopards in the Altai region of Outer Mongolia. To find out more, telephone 01223 352 561.
On the 2nd of February, and every other Thursday pretty much, Hope Street Music runs its Living Room Acoustic Night at CB2, which features some wonderful diverse music there. This is, of course, run partly by none other than Phil P, esteemed presenter of The Scene on 209 Radio, so why not make him happy and go along?
If you want to try something different for 2006, you could go along to the Cambridge Buddhist Centre on Thursday night to their friendly drop-in meditation class.
And if you like salsa dancing, why not head down to Cellar Bar on Napier Street? It's every Sunday from 8 o'clock.
And lastly, on Thursday the 26th, Claire Ellis, who works for the Enigma Project, is giving a talk about the secret world of code and code breaking at the Centre for Mathematical Studies on Clarkson Road.
And if you want us to shout out about an event on So Far and Yet So Near, email us at sofar@209radio.co.uk. And don't forget what must be the biggest event of the year so far, 209 Radio on FM for 1 week, from the 11th of February. You can tune your dial to 103.5 FM and enjoy a week of non-stop community-led radio.
Well, now back to South Africa. A Cambridge University musical event held this week brought together two South Africans, now living here in Cambridge, and a visiting German who normally is resident in South Africa. They put on an eclectic and fascinating performance that had the audience clapping along and asking questions. Afterwards, they shared with us their unique perspective on music and history within their country. First of all, we'll hear Peter Schoop and then Nomfundo Zina Ngwenya shortly. But first, here's the main organiser, Beth Mills, telling me what it was all about.
What I was really hoping for is to bring some of Africa, some of the spirit of Africa's songs and the rhythms and the people into the lives of people in Cambridge. I feel that we're living in a bastion of English Africanness and great to get some cultural diversity happening and out there.
What do you see as the differences between sort of South African music and culture that you don't find here? What is it you miss?
In terms of music, I really miss politically aware music that is making social comments about what's going on in South Africa and what's happening between the different race groups, and actually also exploding the notion of race, that race itself exists, and working with the group of young people that are coming up in South Africa and struggling with their identity as South Africans coming out of a history of apartheid, and how that's expressed through music. I find that wonderful in South Africa, and maybe it's because I don't really know where to look in Cambridge to find that. I'm sure that that's happening here in various different ways.
So do you see sort of music and political struggle sort of intertwined in South Africa?
Absolutely. I think political struggle and also celebration very much is expressed through music. I think that we've moved out of a very dark time and we still need to reflect on it, but we also need to be moving forward into thinking about how we're going to make South Africa work now.
Let's move on to you, Xenia. What's your musical history?
My musical history is mainly choral singing, in keeping with what Beth was saying on the whole cultural post-apartheid, you know, type of music scene in South Africa. We've tended to move towards, I think, generally as a country, music has always been a very powerful tool, so to speak, for just addressing any emotional issue, as Beth has mentioned. So during the struggle, obviously, you know, you had a whole lot of restrictions on public gatherings and so on. Especially between races, we had even things like the Immorality Act, which would bar marriage between black and white and so on. So I think people never really got to speak to each other. Music was used, especially in the black community, more to speaking among yourselves as a community. And post apartheid South Africa, the power of music, it was then decided would be used as a more positive force to address what couldn't be done historically. So there was, you know, a whole lot of choirs mushroomed all over the place, being more cosmopolitan, more cross-cultural, and traveling around the world just singing South African music and integrating it with other influences, obviously, because we're not an island that's separated from everybody else. So just integrating it with other forms of music. So I kind of come from that background of, you know, singing in choirs, but multicultural choirs, spreading understanding, that type of thing.
And one of the things you did last night, you spoke about an amazing South African woman who had taken her South African music to America, I think it was. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Miriam Makeba. She's one of our best known artists. As I said last night, she is quite old. I think she's in her 70s now. She rose to prominence because she got married to in the civil rights movement. The Black Panthers were at some point led by Stokely Carmichael, and she got married to him. But then it was later realized that there was more to this woman than just being Stokely Carmichael's partner or wife or whatever. And the strength of her music actually shone beyond everything else, because she had this amazing way of bringing perhaps musical tolerance to the U.S. Interestingly, yesterday after the performance, a lady came to me and said, oh, we knew Miriam Makeba in France long before she went to the Americans, which is true. I've tended to find that musical awareness is a bit more within Europe. So I can imagine Miriam Makeba found it quite difficult to go in there and say things like, they must have thought, what on earth is this, you know? So she did a lot for promoting South African music.
So you did a little bit of clicking. Can you explain, like, so what? How did she incorporate that into American music?
She wasn't just about clicking, but certainly one of the things that was most popular about her was the clicking. And she had this way of being jazzy, but it wasn't just pure American jazz. It was integrating it with the whole South African thing. And that's where the clicks then became most interesting. If you listen to her live recordings, some of her best applauses come during the click song, because people just don't understand how you can actually flow musically, rhythmically, while you click.
Do you feel able to give us a sample?
Yeah, sure, I can do that.
Thanks ever so much.
This one is called Igqirha Lendlela Nkomo. That's the one that was most popular. It goes, Igqirha Lendlela Nkomo. Igqirha lendlela kuthwa nguQongqothwane. Igqirha lendlela yemama nguQongqothwane. Igqirha lendlela bathi nguQongqothwane.
Sele qabele qutapa haya nguqo ngotwane. Sele qabule qutapa haya nguqo ngotwane.
Yeah, something like that. It's amazing. Thanks ever so much.
All right.
Well, from one form of African music to another, we're now going to turn to another musician. If you could just say your full name.
Peter Schaub.
Excellent. And you've got a drum here with you. Can you tell us a little bit about this drum?
Well, it's a djembe drum. It originates in West Africa, and it has spread at quite a tremendous pace over the world in the last 20 years because it became very popular.
How did you come to play the drum?
Well, I'm from Germany. The last 8 years I've been living in Cape Town, South Africa. And it was two Swiss guys who've been studying music, and they just came back from a trip from West Africa and had Cape Town as the sort of last station, and they kind of jammed in the backpack, and I was completely blown away by the music and by the expression and by the kind of sounds and talking these sort of very simple looking drums could make. And I thought, oh wow, I wouldn't mind exploring that. So I found a West African teacher in Cape Town, which was amazing. And he taught me how to play, and he taught me about the cultural context, the meaning of the djembe, the meaning of the songs, where it comes from, how it is practiced in Mali, which is one of the main countries where it's played in West Africa.
What sort of occasions is the drum used at?
It's incorporated in all parts of life in West Africa. It's been played for giving birth, for marriages, circumcision, all sorts of important events.
Okay then, let's hear some various rhythms that are played at different occasions.
Well, the first one I want to give you a short sample of is called djembe, like the drum, and it is to welcome everyone, to bring people together, to get the community together. And it goes like follows.
Fantastic. And maybe another one?
Another example would be the song which is called Dako. It is to acknowledge a certain kind of tree who gives a very nice fruit, and it's to celebrate that tree and to give thanks to that tree, which goes as follows.
Sound of Peter Schaub drumming, and before him we heard Beth Mills and the singing of Nomfundo Zina Ngwenya performing a song by Miriam Makeba. Search for her name on the web to find out more.
And Peter also mentioned his drumming teacher, Sidi Sangare, who leads the group called Gina Djembe, which Peter is also involved in. So if you like the rhythms you heard and want to learn more about them and also see some pictures, go to djinadmbe.com. Now then, one of the biggest achievements in global medicine has been the development of vaccines for numerous diseases. Now, vaccines are important in all countries, but in the hotter countries of the world, such as those in Africa, South America and South Asia, there is a delivery problem. The fact is, many current vaccines aren't too good at withstanding the hot weather. This is a major issue which needs to be overcome, but one Cambridge-based company is looking to provide the answer. Cambridge Biostability is making tiny globules of glass which contain the vaccines and which can be injected in the usual way. So this week I went over to Biostability's headquarters just off Huntington Road and spoke to Howard Smith about how it all works and how it all relates to a curious desert fern.
What we're trying to overcome is that almost 50% of the vaccines produced are spoiled before they get to the point of delivery. The World Health Organization estimates that this is costing over $200 million per year.
Okay, and what is it that spoils them?
Well, this is getting too hot or even too cold can cause the structure of the vaccine to break down.
So we have here a prop, which I'll quickly describe it. It's essentially looks like a dried up fern. So it's got kind of very, very dry, kind of ferny leaves on it and a few roots there as well. And it's kind of rolled itself up into a ball. So describe to me, what is this plant and why is it special?
Well, this plant is called the resurrection fern, and this is a plant that's found in the desert regions of the southern United States, Arizona, New Mexico, that kind of idea. And the plant itself survives in these very harsh conditions by becoming a dried-out husk. Even though it looks completely dried out and, to all intents and purposes, it is dead, it isn't. It's simply dormant. And what happens when it rains, on the few infrequent times, the plant then rehydrates and becomes opens out into a fully functioning green fern. This process takes about 2 hours, 3 hours at most.
And give me an idea, I mean, for how long could one of these things survive in the dry?
Well, in the dried form, botanical stores have stored these for over 100 years, and they're still viable. So it seems that in real terms, the storage period is indefinite.
This, I suppose, leads on to the kind of vaccine technology you're trying to develop. You're saying that heat can spoil vaccines, and yet this fern, which is clearly a living thing, is able to survive heat and dryness and so on. So how have you been kind of using these principles to make this vaccine technology?
Well, the fern uses a very high concentration of certain sugars in its body, which preserve its structure when it dries out. Normally, if a plant dries out, all the structures within the plant break down and it becomes non-functional. In these particular resurrection ferns, the chemicals in there maintain the structure of the plant. Now, our founder, Bruce Rosa, identified certain chemicals which can do this. And what we do is we take the standard vaccine formulations and encapsulating them in a biocompatible glass. This is something which can be injected into the body, and the vaccine will be fused into the glass in a tiny sphere. These spheres are about 5 microns in diameter, a micron being 1/1000th of a millimetre. As a consequence, they can be injected into the body readily.
So we have here kind of a vial of... Is this actually the vaccine, is it?
It is.
Yeah, okay, so a vial of the vaccine, which is just very small, it's about an inch and a half tall or something, and it's got kind of a milky liquid in it. How then is it administered to somebody, let's say a child?
Well, this vial would be used to fill a syringe, so it is entirely sterile and it is in liquid form. That's very important because certain vaccines, such as the measles vaccine or tuberculosis BCG vaccine, are provided as a freeze-dried powder. The problem is there that the people in the field will need to reconstitute it with water, and that first of all doubles the cost because you have to ship the water to there. Also, human error comes in when the wrong liquid or the wrong amount of liquid is added to the dried powder. This vial will be used for our first trials where you simply draw up the liquid into a syringe, but the final product will probably be delivered as a pre-filled injection device where you simply open the pack, put it onto the patient, press a button and it does everything for you.
This vaccine, where is it now? I mean, are you developing it? Has it been used in anyone yet?
Well, our first project will be a pentavalent vaccine. So that's a vaccine containing 5 separate vaccines. And we've received a grant from the Department for International Development to co-develop this with Panacea Biotech, who are one of the largest vaccine manufacturers in India.
I'd finally like to dwell a little on your location in Cambridge, I suppose. I mean, you said that it came out of some work done at APU and so on. I mean, what is it about Cambridge and how is it beneficial to biostability to be in Cambridge?
Well, first of all, we get a very high quality of people here. When we have recruited, we've always had a very high quality of applicant. And we also collaborate very closely with places like the university or other companies in the area. Cambridge is unique in that it has such a high intensity of biological research going on, and also very good quality people.
That's Howard Smith from Cambridge Biostability, and if you want to find out more, you can go to www.biostability.com.
So, that's all for this episode of So Far and Yet So Near, but please do join us next time during the week of FM broadcast starting on the 11th of February on 103.5 FM.
So, it's goodbye from Hannah and myself, but to play us out, here's some drumming from Peter Schaup, who sent our microphone levels absolutely crazy with this piece of music. Enjoy!